Welcome to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. When President Obama launched a new strategy of engagement with Cuba, the official White House announcement came with a nautical-themed headline. It read, "Charting a New Course in Cuba." Well, it's appropriate, considering less than a year after beginning on that course, cruise ship giant Carnival Corporation hopes to sail into Havana Harbor next spring with passengers. Now, we spend the hour coming up talking with the CEO of Carnival, Arnold Donald, about Cuba, how the company's business has turned around, including what's changed since a ship ran aground and capsized in a fatal crash in Italy and another lost power for days in the Gulf of Mexico. Also, we'll talk about the perception of doing business here as one of the largest publicly traded companies calling South Florida home. But first, Cuba, with Arnold Donald, the CEO of Carnival Corp. Arnold, you are anticipating your Fathom brand to begin cruising from Miami to Cuba. May of 2016 was the original date. You still on schedule?
Right now, of course, we're still on schedule. We're very excited about Fathom. Of course, Fathom initially sails to the Puerto Plata region of the Dominican Republic. That'll occur in April of 2016. And then in May of 2016, hopefully we'll be going to Cuba. You know, we have the U.S. Approvals required to do that, and we are awaiting approvals from Cuba.
What are you hearing back from the folks inside Carnival who are engaging directly with the island, with the Cuban government officials?
Our people are, of course, doing everything that's being requested of them. Everything's very encouraging. Everything's very positive. And we are very confident by cooperating fully and giving a longer-term view because, of course, we're not interested in only sailing to Cuba with the one ship, that we will be granted the approvals required so we can begin our sailings in May of 2016 with Fathom.
Give us an idea of the tone of those conversations Carnival is having with the Cuban government.
The tone's very positive, extremely positive, extremely encouraging, very fact-based. And, so I would say the tone is very encouraging.
What are some of the issues that have come up? And have you engaged directly with Cuban authorities?
There have been no real issues in terms of engaging directly. Obviously, here stateside, here in the U.S., we visited with the Cuban representatives in the embassy now, the Cuban embassy here in the U.S. But frankly, there's been no big obstacles. It's just fact-finding and informational at this point.
Have you engaged directly with Havana officials?
I have not been to Cuba.
You have not been to Cuba?
I have not been to Cuba.
Has the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Cuba impacted your conversations on the island at all?
Not unto itself, but just the opening of relationships obviously has paved the way for us to have the opportunities that we have. And frankly, the historical moment when we became the first cruise company in well over 50 years to be granted a license by the U.S., to sail to Cuba and back again to the U.S. Those requirements are no longer there because things have opened up even more.
On the U.S. side, you no longer need that license.
On the U.S. side. But still, as we've talked earlier, we're awaiting the Cuban approval, and we're very excited and very, very confident that by cooperating and tending to what their needs are, we'll be granted the right to go.
Do you have any sense of a timeline for that Cuban approval?
Sometime before our initial sailing in May of 2016.
So you do anticipate it before 2016, before May.
But May of 2016, because that's when we intend to sail. So we are hopeful, and we are clearly anticipating because we're making all plans to go.
And they're not telling you to stop those plans or to push it back to March of 2017 or anything like that?
No, not
lines.
At all. We have not been granted approval.
Right.
And just like everywhere else in the world we go, we have to have approval by the nation. Their port, or in some places it's a private port, but we have to be approved to enter, and we have again every confidence, but we are very respectful of what the requirements are and are very happy to meet them.
What are your engineers encountering in terms of the infrastructure in the old Havana Harbor that your Fathom ship would dock?
We interestingly, years ago, we have a lot of experience in our company with Cuba. Costa, our Italian brand based in Genoa, actually managed the Havana terminal for a number of years prior to our acquiring the brand. And once we acquired it, we had to cease and desist operations within 6 months of acquisition. But there are still people around who were very involved in those operations and understand that operation well. Moreover, because we're a global maritime entity, we have our own simulator in the Netherlands, in Almere in the Netherlands, and where we chart waters all over the world and run simulations for cruise ships and stuff. So we have a lot of technology and insight. So at this point, our engineers know what they know. Well, obviously, they know a lot more once we're granted rights to cruise.
Have you been able to inspect the infrastructure in and around the harbor?
At this point in time, in terms of recently, we haven't done that,
okay.
But that's obviously going to be done. It was done in the not too distant past, but it hasn't been done again recently.
Do you anticipate Carnival having to make a capital investment at all in Havana in infrastructure to allow your ship initially to
We're fully prepared to make capital investments if that's what's required. So we are anticipating that there might be some requirement there, but we'll see what they want to do.
By what they want to do, the Cubans, could they require the capital investment?
The Cubans might say, look, we understand what your needs are, but if you want that done in this time frame, we may need some assistance or whatever. On the other hand, they may not. They may say, we have what we have and we think it's adequate. There's other capital required, though. If we're going to bring 700 guests there, they have to be transported from whichever terminals they arrive in. And so ground transportation, has to be tended to, receiving areas, those types of things. And not just in Havana, because we're not going to go to one city.
Right.
The ship will sail and it'll be there for a week.
You have three ports of call, as a matter of fact.
Yeah,
right?
At least three. And we'll see over time if there's more. But right now, the plan is three.
And back to this potential capital investment, as you've taken a look at the business model and the projections, what kind of dollar figure are you anticipating in terms of a maximum kind of capital investment that Carnival would be willing to take on this first risk?
We'd have to see. We have no details whatsoever. We'd have to take a look. Obviously, we've made investments all over the world. In fact, we just opened Amber Cove in the Dominican Republic, a new destination that is perhaps one of the best destinations there is right now in the Caribbean. It's a fabulous development, and we just made that investment. That took several years to do. I'm not certain there'll be that level of investment acquired in the short term in Cuba, but we'll see.
We know that major legacy carriers, U.S. Air carriers, are negotiating heavily with Cuba in order to have scheduled commercial flights in and out of Cuba. If they're granted that in the short term, would that impact potential business opportunities that Carnival sees in Cuba?
Right now we think anything that fosters travel to Cuba from the U.S. is a good thing for us. The easier it becomes to travel, the more familiar people become with traveling to Cuba, the better. The advantage we have as a cruise company is that our ships are the hotel. And one of the shortages that currently exists there is accommodations. Even with Airbnb and their great effort there, which I think is also a very positive thing, there is still a shortage of accommodations. As you know, there's hundreds of thousands of American citizens now that go to Cuba. And, of course, Cuba has been open to the rest of the world this entire time. So our ships provide a fantastic accommodation experience. And they also provide, in the case of Fathom Edition and all of our ships, they also provide an easier way to get from place to place in Cuba. There are 11 ports in Cuba. We're going to visit three in our initial itinerary planning. We may modify that as we go over time, again, subject to what we can do and what the preferences are there. But there are so many things to see in Cuba, and there's no easier, better way, more comfortable accommodations with high-end experience all around than a cruise ship.
Among the critics to the new age of engagement on commerce between the United States and Cuba, the criticism focuses on that commerce winding up with the Castro regime ultimately on the island. How do you answer those critics, especially as they say a floating hotel may answer the business challenge of the lack of accommodations in Havana, but it keeps those dollars on the ship, not into the pockets of regular Cubans?
You know, the reality is we're in the cruise business, and we cruise to over 700 ports a year. Every port we enter, we're an economic multiplier. The ships have to be provisioned. There's port charges that go along with it. And then the local communities thrive because it creates jobs, it creates opportunities, whether it's a taxi driver, whether it's a local restaurant, et cetera. And so that won't be any different in Cuba than it is in any of the other 700-plus ports we go to around the world.
You anticipate taking on provisions from the three ports of call in Cuba onto the ship?
At this point, we have to work all that out, mm-hmm. but it would be very surprising to me if we're there for a week that we aren't buying, you know, some provisions locally, especially for, you know, meals and other things on board. But clearly, all that has to be determined. But the reality is we have no doubt we will be an economic boon to the local citizens and wherever ports we go to.
How is doing business in Cuba, even in these early stages, as you have not been approved to do business there, but even as you're negotiating, how is this process any different than other emerging markets that Carnival has identified, especially China?
Well, again, you know, it's interesting. We would call China an emerging market or even Cuba an emerging market because they've had tourism.
The proportion is much different, of course.
Well, Cuba's had tourism for many, many years.
Sure.
It's just not from the U.S. To us, it's not very different. The reality is every country we go to, they have their own regulations. They have their own whatever. And we have to honor those wherever we go. And we go to ports, as I've mentioned, over 700 of them all over the world. So, you know, to us is business as usual, and the business as usual is paying attention to the specifics wherever we're going. And there are different specifics wherever we go. But it's just basic sound business practice. Wherever we go, we want to be a welcomed guest. We want to be a proactive partner, and we want to be a benefit to the communities we touch. That's our objective while exceeding our guests' expectations. And we think we do that reasonably successfully, and we're always trying to do it even better.
How have sales been for the planned excursions to Cuba beginning May of 2016?
Well, you know, we've only now, while we had billions of media impressions, in fact, over 18 billion media impressions from the
almost three times as many people on the planet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So lots of interest. But the reality is we only recently activated the ability to book to book with us.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how that goes. But, you know, we have every confidence that I would encourage people listening, if they want this experience, which is going to be, you know, probably, you know, the best way to experience Cuba, you know, they should go online and or call their travel agent, which would be even better, and book with us.
You got to keep those parties happy, certainly, right? Yeah, those business parties.
Yeah, not only the business part, yeah, the partners in terms of the travel agents. The reality is we are very dependent on the travel agent community to effectively communicate what cruising is, because a lot of people misunderstand what cruising is.
Assuming you get the okay from the Cuban government to dock that first ship in May of 2016 in Havana, will you be on it?
Oh, absolutely, I'll be on our inaugural cruise. I most definitely will be, yes.
Still to come, more with the CEO of Carnival, Arnold Donald, including the company's improving fortunes.
Our challenge is not other cruise companies. Our competition is land-based vacations.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. We're talking this hour with the head of one of South Florida's biggest publicly traded companies. Carnival Corp has a market value of more than $38 billion. That makes it the second largest company calling South Florida home. Only FPL's parent company, NextEra Energy, has a bigger market value. One measure of a company's success is its stock price. Now, Carnival's stock trades under the symbol CCL on the New York Stock Exchange. It's gone up been priced twice as much as the overall stock market in the 2+ years since Arnold Donald took over as CEO. Now, Donald had been a member of the Carnival Board of Directors for a decade before becoming the company's top executive. In June, Jim Cramer of CNBC interviewed you, and he called it
one of the most impressive turnaround stories of our era, if not the most impressive turnaround.
He said you masterminded the entire turn. Those are direct quotes. You were sitting on stage on set when he said those. The stock price of CCL up 45% since you were named CEO of the company. You sat on the board for better than a decade before you were called in on a day-to-day operational standpoint. How is business for Carnival?
Business is great, but I have to, as I pointed out to Jim on air, and I will with you, is that I inherited a great company with a great foundation, founded by a great leader in Mickey Arison. And his father, and then led for many years by Mickey. And Mickey continues to be our chairman. So I have the world's expert in cruise at my beck and call 24/7, and that's a very helpful thing to have. But yes, we've done well. So we grew earnings 14 over 13 by 25%. Our guidance, as we said in our last earnings call, for this year is to grow 35% on top of that. Things are going very well.
There's not a weak spot in the portfolio is what you're saying.
All of our brands, each one is unto itself a world-leading cruise line. Each one caters to a different psychographic guest. So the guests on board are very different from one cruise to the next or one brand to the next. And they are all in their own right very powerful world-recognized brands that deliver a great experience. Absolutely, we exceed our guest expectations.
And I want to talk about the guest expectations in a moment, but I want to spend a little bit of time with the business operations here, because the shareholders have been richly rewarded under your tenure, 45% share price increase, with the 10 brands with their own 10 identities, perhaps a couple of years ago, even after the Great Recession was over. There was a discount in your share price because of the lack of continuity in business operations where there was commonality among those 10 brands. That's been a focus of your turnaround efforts, is to keep those brands individually identifiable because of the demographics that they choose, but where they can cooperate more, even to a point of, I believe it's a common call among top executives, is simple things like a conference call on everybody's calendar.
Right. Yeah, we meet weekly with all the top execs.
What are those like?
Every week. Those are great. We cover health, environmental safety first, of course. We make sure that there's any learnings from the week to further improve on the great safety record that exists in our industry. And then we also obviously go through the financials, and then we go through the challenges and, more importantly, the opportunities that exist. And it's shared experiences, sharing best practices, is common ideation. And again, our brands, you mentioned the word demographics. You know, the reality is our brands are organized around psychographics. Mm-hmm. And people can be in different psychographic categories at a time. For example, if you're going to cruise with your college buddies, you want one kind of an experience. Yeah. If you're going to cruise with your parents, it's a different one. With your significant other, you want a romantic, that's a different experience.
Sure, sure.
So people can move across these psychographic categories as individuals, but each brand is really geared around a particular psychographic experience.
And what you've seen under your leadership is a real focus on cost. The top line has grown, in other words, revenues, but you've really focused on costs. Energy costs especially have dropped double digits. I'm assuming you don't have necessarily any magical powers over the price of oil, but you've been able to take advantage of that. Right. But you've also seen your cost of payroll drop year over year in the last quarter, for instance, and your cost of food has dropped. A couple of things you do have direct control over. How have you done it?
Well, what we do is, first of all, is cost containment is what we're chasing. You know, our mission is to deliver double-digit return on invested capital the next 3 to 4 years for our shareholders' benefit. To achieve that, we have to do that with the top line, with revenue growth. But costs can be a drag on those earnings. And if we contain costs, we free up dollars to invest to drive the revenue. And so how we do that is through communicating, collaborating, and coordinating across our 10 brands. Our unique advantage is our scale. One of every two people who cruise in the world cruise on one of our brands. All of the cabins in the world from all the cruise companies add up to 2% of the hotel rooms in the world. And so our challenge is not other cruise companies, because 1% of that 2% is already ours. We're chasing the other 98%. Mm-hmm. Our competition is land-based vacations. Mm-hmm. And when we look at cost, just by communicating, coordinating, and collaborating across the brands, we can buy airline travel together. And pulling all the brands together, we're the fifth largest purchaser in the world of airline travel. We can buy mattresses smarter. We have a lot of mattresses on board. And by sharing specs and single sourcing and sharing the sourcing effort, and it goes on and on and on.
Uniforms, shoes, you've talked aprons,
shoes,
you've talked
food,
about these kinds of
beverages,
things. Yeah.
Everything. Yeah,
right.
And we buy a quarter of a million pairs of shoes a year for the crew. And again, by collaborating and communicating and coordinating across those brands, obviously we can leverage and take advantage of our scale. So those are areas where we will contain costs, but actually the way to deliver for the shareholder ultimately is to create more demand for cruising and to take advantage of that, and to give, of course, our guests more of what they want when they're on board. Understanding what they want is the trick, it's the magic in the sauce. But if we understand it and make it available, they'll purchase it. So we've had a nice increase over the last couple of years in onboard revenues. And people want all kinds of things. It depends which brand it is.
Onboard revenues, for those who haven't cruised, are something that you spend money
on board
other
yeah.
than the ticket.
Right.
Other than the
so if you're
going to
buy
onboard.
That pair of sunshades,
yeah.
If we have it available on board, then that's an incremental retail sale opportunity.
You've
for
said,
us.
I believe, it's if every passenger that's on board a Carnival brand spends $12 more per day, that's
God.
$1 billion annually in extra revenue for you.
Absolutely, yes, because we have roughly 80 million passenger cruise days a year.
Yeah.
And so $1 is $80 million.
Let me ask you about business here, continuing. In your last quarterly announcement during the fiscal third quarter this summer, you said the 2016 bookings were running 20% higher than a year ago, capacity up just 3%. Law of supply and demand, you're seeing demand increase and you're not increasing supply. Does that mean higher prices?
Well, I would encourage people who want to cruise to book sooner rather than later. I know historically people have thought, well, if I wait, some people have, if I wait to book, maybe I can get a lower price. But if you want the cabin you want, the itinerary you want at the time you want it, I would recommend booking earlier.
I want to tackle one part of the cost structure on energy. Energy costs are significant for you, no doubt about
yeah,
it. You
absolutely. So our single largest expense item is energy.
Even beyond payroll.
Beyond payroll,
even
yes.
beyond payroll.
Yes. We've reduced fuel consumption collectively since 2007, probably 25%.
Even while expanding
the fleet. In terms of quarter to quarter, it's more like a 2%, not so much, but this quarter compared to the same quarter last year.
Okay.
Probably like about a 2% reduction.
You're not
but
saving
those,
fewer.
Those fuel consumption savings are really important to us. Both as a small environmental footprint, although frankly, we as a company and the industry, has a very small footprint overall in terms of environmental. But, we still want to do our fair share. And fuel conservation is just a smart move. It's a smart move business-wise for us, and it's a smart move, period.
We asked some of our social media followers for questions for you, Mr. Donald, okay. And Aaron Finkel on Facebook sent us this question regarding your business operations. Has the business model for Carnival changed from an all-inclusive model to an a la carte model?
No, the all-inclusive concept has existed for decades in cruise, and at different times, different brands have taken on various aspects of all-inclusive. But for the Carnival brand itself, while you can get certain packages, you can get a beverage package, for example, you might be able to get some shore excursion packages, that sort of thing, that in the main, we prefer to let the guests choose on the Carnival brand what they want and have them pay for what they want. And so that's giving the guest a choice, we feel. If you go like more on a Seabourn brand, where it's, super ultra luxury, typically, psychographically, again, those guests, tend to prefer to have things more all-inclusive. So there will be more of a direction towards all-inclusive at a Seabourn, much less of that, say, on like a Carnival brand.
Does it make sense for any of the Carnival brands to go to a model a la Spirit Airlines, where you're buying a pillow, but if you want to bring a bag on board, you're going to have to pay slightly more, or bring two bags on board, pay slightly more.
Well, when it comes to...
If you want to eat at 4 o'clock, you pay maybe slightly less than if you want to eat at 6 o'clock, for instance.
When it comes to luggage and that type of thing, I don't anticipate seeing us charging by bag or anything for guests. And we probably won't get to the point where we're charging for every single thing. For example, on most of our cruise lines, most of them, room service is 24/7 and there's no extra charge. There might be in some... They may charge for certain items that you want in room service, et cetera. And so those things are always subject to change in the future. But for us, the idea is to exceed guests' expectations, you know, to provide an experience that is incomparable and leaves the guests, you know, so excited that they become our marketing machine because they can't stop talking about the great experience they had.
Still to come, how Carnival has recovered from two bad cruising experiences, the fatal capsizing of a ship in Italy and a vessel without power in the Gulf of Mexico.
The one case was a tragedy. The other is just a voyage disruption. It's like being stuck on the runway.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. We're talking this hour with the Carnival Corporation CEO, Arnold Donald. It's been almost 4 years now since the Costa Concordia cruise ship sailed too close to the Italian island of Giglio, ran aground, and capsized. 32 people died. It's been almost 3 years now since the Carnival Triumph lost power for days and had to be towed back to port from the Gulf of Mexico. Now, Donald says the company has moved on while focusing on passenger experience.
If there's a thesis and a mission that you've had as your leadership tenure has continued, it is exceed guests' expectations. You've said it many times here during our interview. You've said it publicly since you were named CEO about 2 years ago. What do guests want? What are guest expectations today, and how have they evolved?
You know, we have 10 brands, and the guests want very different things on those brands. And so, for example, Carnival... It's a very social brand. The people that sail on Carnival, they like being the life of the party or like being around the life of the party. They want to engage socially with other people. They want to engage socially with the crew. And so that's what they want. You know, Seabourn is one-to-one, crew to guests. They want a very different thing. You know, they want pampering. They want, generally speaking, not as, you know, they want more quiet. They're not looking, you know, for the fun, great atmosphere, but they still want to be, you know, dined well. Thomas Keller is our chef on Seabourn. So those are extremes, and there's all kinds of things in the middle. So fundamentally, I would say the one common denominator for a guest, no matter whether they're mass contemporary and want fun, or they're super luxury and want to be pampered, is they want an experience that's tailored to their needs and their desires. And so in each brand, we study that to death. And we try to make certain every guest, if they're paired with the right experience, you know, feels that they got an experience designed for them. And that's the one common thing. What the details are on that varies dramatically.
You mentioned the social aspect of the Carnival brand. Of course, it was back in the mid and late 1980s when it was known as the Fun Ship.
If they could see you now out on a Fun Ship cruise, you're eating fancy food.
Kathy Lee and Frank Gifford dancing and singing around it.
At the first rate Carnival cruise that you took.
There's another commonality, I think, in that guest experience, which is, of course, security and safety. Some challenges that you have had to deal with head-on during your tenure as the CEO of Carnival. In 2012, of course, it was the Costa Concordia in Italy and the tragedy there as it ran aground and a few dozen passengers lost their lives and crew members. 2013, the Triumph had an engine failure in the Gulf of Mexico. 4,000 passengers and crew left adrift for several days with no power. What kind of assurances can you give your guests these days that these safety failures, human or mechanical, are being addressed?
Well, first of all, we've moved on beyond those, but obviously the Concordia was a tragedy. And that's a tragedy in maritime history. It's a one-off thing. It hardly ever happens, ever. And that was a tragedy. And obviously, whether it is something like that or just some minor disruption at sea, we study it. We share it with the maritime industry. We study other people's, whether it's cargo or passenger, because the maritime industry has a long history of continuous improvement in the safety area. And it's one reason why it has such a tremendous safety record. We have thousands. Well, we have 80 million passenger cruise days a year, 80 million. And you mentioned a few thousand people or a few thousand people there. So in general, it's one of the safest activities you can do. Having said that, the Triumph was actually, no one was injured, no one was hurt. It wasn't really adrift, it was being towed. And
it lost power.
It did lose
before
power.
Before it was lost able power. To be towed.
And so what we have done, and learning from that experience, is we put in some additional, we had redundancy on that ship, but we put in some additional redundancies in terms of alternative power generators to ensure that in the highly unlikely event a ship was to lose power for an extended period of time from the main source, that we were equipped with additional backup redundancies to ensure the guest comfort. So we are in continuous improvement mode, always have been. The industry is, as well as ourselves. And I would just assure any guest to talk to anyone around the S cruise, and you'll find that 99.9% of the time, they're just having a great vacation experience.
You launched and announced a $700 million investment in safety and security after the Triumph situation when it did lose power. How far along in that project are you?
We're all nearing the completion of that now. We've invested in, again, these additional generators for backup power. We did some switchboard changes in some instances. We also upgraded to some of the newer technologies available for fire prevention, detection, and suppression systems, and so on. And so we would have done a lot of that anyway. But the reality is, we have invested, and we've got a tail that ships go in the dry dock. But it's an ongoing process. We'll always be adding additional features, upgrading to the newest and latest technologies. It's just a good practice, and it's one reason why the industry has such a fantastic safety record.
Regarding the policies, you talk about mechanical and technological investments. What about policy and procedure investment? Any of those things changed after or because of the Triumph situation?
Absolutely. Similarly, we do look at procedures and processes all the time, and a number of things changed. Again, many of them would have changed anyway, but there were certainly specific learnings. Many of the learnings had nothing to do with the incident or the outcome from the incident. It's just by studying in detail. For example, on one incident we noticed that there was some confusion because of the many languages on board. So we tweaked our processes for communicating effectively when there could be 40 different, languages
with spoken, passengers,
with guests, spoken.
Yeah.
We evolved to some additional advisory groups to have, we're leading the industry with our HES committee on the board, which I served on for quite a while before I took over as CEO. But we added advisory boards at some of the brand levels as well. And I brought in a new head of maritime, a three-star admiral, William Burke, who joined us from the Pentagon. And he's been very helpful in, again, adding and enhancing to what we have already have in place.
How did the image of cruising change with those incidents, and how has it changed because of Carnival's response?
I think, again, the incidents, the one case was a tragedy. The other is just a voyage disruption. It's almost the equivalent. It takes longer. It took more time and whatnot. But like being stuck on the runway on a plane.
Yeah, well, for a good number of days. I mean, there are a lot of complaints.
That one's for a good number of days. Yeah. Actually, there were a few complaints, but the vast majority of people on that cruise thanked us and said how great they were taken care of. Mm. And so a lot of the imagery and stuff you saw wasn't really the experience on the ship.
The idea of the backed up toilets and the lack of
fresh
water.
Yeah, that wasn't, you know, people had water and they had food and it wasn't hot food. They were, you know, they were definitely not with all the creature comforts they were expecting on their cruise, and their vacation was disrupted. But they appreciated the way they were taken care of. There were some people who were legitimately upset. I wouldn't begrudge anyone a right to be upset that their vacation was disrupted and they were in an uncomfortable situation they couldn't control.
And you've seen business recover.
Yeah, well, business, actually, the funny thing about cruises is the people that cruise, they know. So we never lost anything with people that were already cruising. But our challenge is on every itinerary, you know, we have to fill a certain number, not that many actually, of new-to-cruise. And so when you're going to new-to-cruise, there's reasons why they haven't cruised already. And if they're seeing negative imagery on TV or they're hearing it on the radio or seeing it in print, that's another reason for them not to take the cruise experience.
When one of your vessels leaves port with a few thousand passengers on board, how many of those are experiencing one of your brands for the first time?
It varies, again, across the brands, but typically it can be anywhere from 10 to 30 to 40%, you know, that kind of. Now, if it's in China, it might be 90%.
It may be the first time they're cruising.
It may be 90% of those have never cruised before, or 95 even. But in the more mature markets, like North America and Europe, you know, typically it could be as much as 40% or on a given cruise, but as little as 10.
When talking about your guest expectations here, I want to go back to a comment you mentioned earlier in terms of the financial operations and places where you see opportunities, including kind of collective negotiations among those 10 brands to other vendors. You mentioned mattresses. You've got dozens of thousands of mattresses. But you're doing more than just buying mattresses. In some cases, I believe you're trying to work with the manufacturers to design a better cruising mattress. What's that process like?
Absolutely. So the process is that we have interior design specialists and interior experience and exterior experience specialists. And so what we want is to deliver to that guest, you know, just a phenomenal experience.
What makes for a good cruise mattress compared to a land-based mattress?
Unfortunately, I'm not a perfect mattress expert.
Okay.
But what I can tell you is that it's not so much versus a land mattress, it's which mattress is going to give the guest the best sleeping experience. And that could be potentially on land or at sea. And as we look worldwide for that across our brands, the brands collaborated on specs. And of course, you know, that can vary by the guest. You know, and guests can, you know, one guest may need a more firm mattress, some might need a soft mattress, et cetera. And so, you know, we do a lot of research. We talk to the guests, we survey the guests, and then we align around specs that we think will deliver to the majority of the guests that are targeted for that particular brand, the experience they're seeking.
Another guest experience that Carnival Corp has changed lately is the ability to bring liquor on board, glass bottles, for instance. You've limited that, in fact, banned passengers from bringing bottled booze on board. You can still bring a certain amount of water on board, but the bottles of rum, the bottles of tequila, you've banned that. Why?
Well, in fact, on the Carnival brand in particular, they've discontinued the water as well. The biggest reason is because, first of all, just getting onto the ship. You have to go through TSA and so on and so forth. So it delays embarkation, is a hassle for the guests. And so we just decided to say, look, you know, we'll, you know, dramatically lower the price of water so people don't feel like they need to pre-shop. They can get the water on board. And the same thing with the alcohol, that, you know, people trying to bring alcohol on board, all that stuff has to be inspected. So from a convenience factor for our guests and an experience factor for our guests, because we want to exceed their expectations, and for safety reasons, that's the primary reason.
When the Sunshine Economy returns, more to come with the CEO of Carnival Corporation on doing business in South Florida.
What I see is a thriving community that's really kind of a world city.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening.
When the first Carnival cruise ship set sail in 1972, the company had only one ship. Today it has 100 spread across the globe, sailing under 10 different brand names, headquartered here in South Florida. Arnold Donald spends most of his time here now after a corporate career based in St. Louis. Donald knows business here, though, since he's been on the board of directors of Carnival Corp. Since 2001. He's been CEO of the company since 2013.
It's a great business environment here. You can see, the construction that's going on. But the quality of employees is very high here in South Florida for our business. The human spirit that exists here is very high. It's high energy. It's a very diverse community, a very inclusive community. And these are really positive things for not only business environment, but overall quality of life.
It's interesting you talk about the quality of the workforce for Carnival Corporation. We talk to a lot of CEOs, both big CEOs with large private companies, public companies, and small companies. And almost across the board, they talk about the difficulty of recruiting a quality workforce for South Florida.
I think, I don't know what the unemployment here is, but
it's
I think it's
5 to 6%. It's very low.
It's very low. Yeah. And that may be why they're saying the difficulty of recruiting is because, there's not a lot of people who aren't employed. And so our attitude is if we create the right work environment and create the right growth opportunities, we'll be able to hire the people we need to hire. And so we
are you finding them locally or you're bringing them from other locations?
We do both. We hire locally, obviously. When you get to some of the more senior managerial ranks, there's not a lot of other corporations here. And so then that pool shrinks dramatically.
And I want you to talk about that, to gauge the business climate here, given the lack of big Fortune 500 companies, big publicly traded companies that are part of the S&P 500 stock index. Minneapolis has more of those than Miami.
Right. A lot of that stuff's historical. At one point, St. Louis was, had the highest per capita number of Fortune 500 companies of any city.
Budweiser, McDonnell Douglas, and others.
Yeah, that was more than New York or L.A. So you have to be careful with those types of statistics. The historical reasons of why you don't have a lot of corporations headquartered here, I'm not aware of. I'm afraid I'm not knowledgeable. But what I can tell anyone who's considering coming here, it's a great environment. And obviously people love living here. And we consider it a great place to call home.
I'd like you to gauge that business climate beyond the weather, beyond the lack of state personal income taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Gauge the climate here from a regulatory standpoint, from a workforce quality standpoint, retention and recruitment, from the ability to grow your business domestically as well as internationally from a base here in South Florida.
Again, I can only speak to our experience, and our experience has been very, very positive. So we've been able to attract the talent at the entry levels and above that here locally. We obviously also attract people from all over the country who want to relocate here, which is also a positive thing. As I mentioned, in the more senior ranks, that can be a bit more challenging. Although recently I brought in my chief procurement officer for the corporation, and she was already here. She was based here working with another company. And so there are those top senior level talent people available locally, but obviously not as many as there would be in New York or LA or maybe even Minneapolis.
How do you think the lack of large corporate infrastructure, a large corporate environment here impacts the business climate, impacts the cultural climate, the social climate?
I think culturally and socially, this is a thriving community. It's very diverse and very inclusive. And while there may not be large corporations here, there are very successful people here. And those people tend to be philanthropic in this community. We have a great arts center here. We have an NFL football team. We have
a challenged one, but yeah,
we have an NBA world championship.
Yeah,
team.
Your boss, in fact, is behind
my
that
boss,
one.
Big Harrison.
That's right.
Exactly.
Yes.
You have one of the greatest baseball stadiums in the country, and so from a sports
waiting for the team to come along to fill it up, though. But sure,
from a sports and a cultural standpoint, is very rich. From a higher education standpoint, it's rich. With the universities here in the area. And so what I see is a thriving community that's really kind of a world city because you have so many people from Latin America and now from the Soviet Union and what was formerly the Eastern Bloc, lots of Western Europeans. So you see people from all over the world, calling Miami home. So many of them, it is their primary residence. Others, it may be a second or third residence, but they're still part of the community. So I see the quality of life here is high. The quality of experiences here is high. And like most places in the country, this is not unique to Miami. The education system, the public education system can always be enhanced, and we all should work towards that. Obviously, there's lots of excellent private education here. But it's a great place to raise a family and to live.
I want to ask you, Carnival operates around the world and sees business climates and regional and local economies across the United States and across the world and all the places of the ports of call that you operate in and have administrative negotiations with and administrative relationships with. Is Miami the home for Carnival for the future?
Yes. As far as I'm concerned, I don't see any reason in the world why we would consider relocating our headquarters from Miami. It's a great place to call home. The busiest cruise port in the world is right here in Miami. The Port of Miami has been an outstanding partner to Carnival for many years and to the other cruise companies as well. And it makes sense for us to be here.
Still to come with the CEO of Carnival Corp, choices from wardrobe to a career goal. We're back on the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. The usual corporate executive photo is a plain picture, something akin to a school photo, but for adults. Arnold Donald's official CEO photograph for Carnival Corporation is slightly different. It's his tie. It's the first thing you notice. It's not the usual power red or a subtle blue. It's maroon with crayon drawings of two kids tossing a basketball woven into the fabric. It's not the usual Captain of America industry wardrobe choice. It's a tie from Save the Children, a nonprofit that concentrates on needy kids worldwide. Donald has a long history of making intended choices. He tells the story about setting his professional goal early in life.
General manager in a Fortune 50 science-based global company.
Now, that was when he was a high school junior in New Orleans. That's when he came up with it. He accomplished it not that many years later as a top executive at Monsanto, technically a Fortune 100, not Fortune 50 company. But who's counting? He built his career in the food industry, making what people need, and now leading a cruise company, selling what he hopes people want. Though he sees his product now, cruises, as fulfilling a basic human need.
And that basic human need is not just the variety of life that you experience on a cruise, but it really is the connection, and it's the human spirit.
Arnold Donald, the CEO of Carnival Corporation. You can read more on our website at WLRN.org. One more note, this program and Carnival share a composer, Ed Kalehoff. Years after writing this theme, I met Ed on a different project. We were starting this program, and Ed offered to give us some musical help. We got Ed. We did not get Kathy Lee. Wanda Miles is our technical director. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.